This week on Art of the Air features licensed resort executive chef Eric Hines, who developed a menu inspired by Potawatomi heritage. Next, North Louisiana-based artist Tony Bianco, who is focused on a variety of subjects, and mixed media artist and instructor Anna Barras of Star Girl Crafts. Our spotlights on Canterbury Summer Theater's Love is a Many Splintered Thing, running June 19th through the 29th.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. We'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight from the Canterbury Theater, and they're back again to talk about their next show as part of their 38th season. We have Ray Scott Crawford, who's the artistic director, and this time we have music director John Burst, and they're going to talk about their upcoming show, Love is a Many Splintered Thing. Gentlemen, welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be here.
Very nice seeing both of you.
So, Ray Scott, I guess I'll punt first to you talking about what the show briefly is about, and then we're going to go to John, who's our music director.
Well, it's interesting, and I always worry when someone says interesting, because what does that mean? It is a show without dialogue, so it is continually, story is told through the lyrics of the songs, and it's favorite songs from top 40 songs from the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, and they're all intermersed into a number of medleys, so we get the idea what the characters are going through in their love journeys through their songs. It's really kind of cool. There's three couples, and they go through various stages. The first half is shortly out of high school. The second half's about 10 years later. So we see where their relationships have gone and how they've developed.
So we actually have that whole period, but it's the same characters from Act 1 into Act 2. Is that correct?
Correct.
You've already cast this show, I believe. I think, and obviously you haven't started rehearsal for it yet, but by the time this enters, you'll be going to. So.
Right. Yeah, we cast starting at the beginning of the year, and then we get the company together. We arrive in Michigan City on June 1st. And start rehearsals at that time. So by this point, we will be ready to put the show on the boards.
That's excellent. Well, John, this is your first time on Art on the Air Spotlight. Welcome. But tell us a little bit about some of the challenges that you're going to have with this. I mean, you're obviously dealing with some very popular music, but, you know, working with the cast and everything. But tell us a little bit about music directing on this.
Sure. You know, one of the natures of doing summer stock is working really quickly and getting a lot of material in the actors and actresses' hands very quickly, memorizing it, but then also bringing it to life and really adding the performance aspect of it. So there's kind of the time crunch. You know, we all play beat the clock. It's kind of like working retail at Christmas time. So when we show up, we all get to know each other really quickly. We learn each other through our work. You know, we get to work right away. And a nice thing about this is that so many of the songs are familiar to people. They will be an instant familiarity with the music. But in terms of the story that we're telling, it's, you know, like Ray Scott said, it's true that the music will do a lot of the work for us. But in terms of putting the song in a specific context, and then, again, as Ray Scott had said, if the song is part of a medley, keeping it in that fuller context. So there's a familiarity that will help us, But also we have to build on that then and kind of put the song into our show and into the scene, into the moment that we're building. So that's kind of it in a nutshell.
You know, I have a question and either one of you can answer. So will the cast be at the farmer's market doing a little preview for this show?
Our plan is yes, as we have in the past, yes.
Is there any cast members that overlap your previous show, A Lifespan of a Fact?
Yes, all of them will be involved in the show.
Okay, so they're moving from that one into right into that. They're producing on some nights just like almost good old repertory theater and rehearsing in probably the daytime for most of the other things.
Yeah, for the first couple of shows, they actually are rehearsing both shows at the same time. So you might have a morning rehearsal for one show, an afternoon for another, and then an evening for both or one or the other. So it just... they're working all the time.
John, because we'll take a quick minute here, tell us a little bit about your background for our audience.
So I come to Michigan City as both a music director and a stage director. I'll actually be stage directing in the season as well. That's how I do it. I work professionally as an actor, a director, and a music director. I also teach. I'm a theater educator. This is my fifth summer here at Michigan City and at Canterbury, and I'm thrilled to be back working with Ray Scott and David again and the company. So, you said you've got a theater background yourself, Larry. You can't afford to specialize too much. The more you can work, the more skills you have. So I'm glad to use my full skill set here to come back to Michigan City.
That's excellent. Yeah, I know my start is like both as a lighting designer and doing sound and sound design, and kind of got thrown into directing. And, you know, as you well know, if you really are lighting design and not just lighting the stage, there's a lot of aspects of understanding the mood, moves, and also part of directing is communicating. And I think I'm a very intuitive director. And, yeah, I understand that. You kind of build your skill set that way and everything. So where do you do education at?
I'm currently down in Miami at the University of Miami.
Okay, excellent. And what connected you with Canterbury?
Well, a few years ago, it's really kismet. You know, it's very fortuitous. I was working in a different education situation, and I had worked a lot in my region. And my colleagues said, you know, it would be great if you could get out and work somewhere else in the country. So I just kind of shot a mass email out through a network that I was a part of. And I said, you know, I'm a theater artist. Here's my resume, and I'm available to work outside of this region. And if anyone's interested, please let me know. And Ray Scott bit. So that put us together in our first season. And, you know, again, I've directed and music directed that summer. So it's a very similar setup. But it was pure fate. You know, Ray Scott had a need. I had a skill set, and that brought us together.
Lucky fate, because... the shows are just so professional and excellent there. It was a good landing.
Well, thank you so much, Esther. And as I said, I'm very happy to be back. So thanks to everyone.
And we're very happy to have you back, John.
It's great.
And John, which show are you actually directing?
Well, Ray Scott and I are still kind of working that out to see what the needs of the season are. We've talked about starting here, starting now. We've talked about country is. Some of those things are still being worked out, but I'll be happy to work on anything.
Just a little over a minute left here. So Ray Scott will give you a chance to kind of recap the show and also show dates and how people can find Canterbury in wonderful Michigan City.
It's Love is a Many Splintered Thing, and it is a jukebox musical, fast-paced, zippy, hooray, it's fun about love. It's at the Canterbury Summer Theater, which is 807 Franklin Street in downtown Michigan City. Well, the best way is to go through the website, canterburytheater.org. Then you can order tickets online. It opens on June 19th and runs through the 29th. We have Thursday, Friday, Saturday evening, Wednesday matinee, Thursday, Friday, Saturday evening shows. That's the way it works. Tickets, highest price is $20, and we have some discounted tickets available for various groups. The telephone number for tickets, 219-874-4269.
Well, we appreciate you gentlemen coming on Art in the Air Spotlight. John Burst, he's the music director all season. Of course, Ray Scott Crawford is the artistic director, actually co-artistic director with David Graham. Not on this call. Thank you for much coming on Art in the Air Spotlight.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for an excellent season again.
Thank you both.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Lakeshore Public Media is brought to you by McCauley Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
Hey, this is singer-songwriter from the region, Kevin Friend, and you're listening to Art on the Air at Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Chef Eric Hines to Art on the Air. Chef Eric combines his passion for ethnobotany, anthropology, and food to offer fresh perspective and a desire to demonstrate to modern audiences how people in the past foraged and dined. With 23 years of experience in the culinary and fine dining industries, Chef Eric, along with Dr. Ezekiel Flannery, presented the culinary anthropology programs that will offer new ways to connect the past and the present. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Eric. It's very nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you guys. Thank you for having me.
Well, Eric, we always like our guests to tell a little bit about their background, their origin story. I always like to say how they got from where you were or where you are now.
Well, right now, I'm actually at my day job, which is Square Roots, Indiana, in Crown Point, Indiana. I just got done setting up the kitchen. And we're getting ready to do lunch service. So, yep, that's where I am right now. As far as where I'm from, I'm originally from Evergreen Park, Illinois. Then we moved out to Lowell, Indiana. And, yeah, I, you know, have kind of just been raised by people that cook and was kind of born into it. You know, my grandpa owned a restaurant and on the south side of Chicago, and also my great-grandma on my dad's side. So, yeah, I'm just kind of bred into it.
What's a family get-together then? So what were you exposed to? What were the meals like? What was the cooking experience like?
Oh, you know, just, I guess, lots of food. I mean, food of all types, really.
Like, some families just get together for holidays, but did you have an extended family that got together more frequently than holidays?
Well, because all of our, most of my family is still up in Chicago. It was mostly like, you know, get togethers around like holidays, you know, birthdays, funerals, unfortunately. So yeah, I guess that's typical for most families, I guess, right now. And we're as close as we can be given the circumstances.
So kind of to follow up what Esther was asking, maybe is, was there a certain kind of food that your family did as a tradition? I think is maybe what she was asking. Like, did you have a, like for a certain holiday or something like that? Or, you know, was there a certain kind of cuisine that your family liked?
Because my grandma, I mean, like, you know, when we went to grandma's, we had, oh my gosh, different food than when we went to my aunt's, I guess, you know, so.
Yeah, I mean, God, we had food of all types, really. I guess that's really where, like, my love of food comes from, just because, like, I was introduced to so many different kinds of food from, you know, different sides of the family. So, yeah, I mean, really a little bit of everything. Like, typical stuff that you would find on the south side of Chicago, you know, like tavern-style pizza, you know, Italian beefs, you know, stuff like that. Then, like, going to my aunt and uncle's house here out in Munster and for, like, you know, getting together for, like, Thanksgiving, Christmas, stuff like that, and having, like, the typical, like, holiday fare, you know, like turkey, you know, ham, you know, stuff like that. Typical things that you would find. But, yeah, really anything.
Well, what about your schooling?
Oh, my schooling? Yeah. Well, I actually never went to culinary school. I kind of got started early in the game as far as, like, getting my foot in the door in restaurants, and I wanted to go to culinary school, but chefs that I was working under at the time, I kind of expressed to them that I wanted to go to culinary school, and they kind of talked me out of it, you know, ironically enough. They're like, look, kid, you know, you got your foot in the door, you're already doing great, you already are starting to learn a lot, like, more than, you know, you'd be learning in culinary school. Like, they basically put me like this, like, if you go to culinary school, they're just going to show you how to use a knife, and then you're going to be saddled with, you know, debt the rest of your life. So they're like, you got foot in the door, you're doing great, just, you know, stick to what you're doing. So I, you know, kind of just followed their advice, and, you know, I have to say, like, I'm kind of glad that I did listen to them. I'm not advocating that everybody should not go to school, because I definitely think, you know, school serves its purpose. But for me, it just kind of worked out, you know, the way it did. And I'm kind of happy it did, because, you know, current state of things, I definitely don't like the debt.
So tell us about some of the rest, you know, since that was actually your training, is that, but, like, on the job training, tell us about your kind of history of, like, places you've worked and chefs you work for. And because that was actually your school, is actually the Hard Knock School.
Right. Yeah. So, I got my my first job was actually at a pizza place, was at Arilla's in Lowell. And after that, you know, just kind of bounced around from, you know, place to place for a multitude of reasons. And so I guess the first notable place that I worked at was probably the Lighthouse, which is where I met my, you know, current girlfriend, my girlfriend of 15 years, by the way. we both met at the Lighthouse in Cedar Lake. I had been out in Ireland for a little bit with my family, and moved back. And right after, we came back, that's when the Lighthouse, I saw an ad in the paper that this place called the Lighthouse was opening. So I, applied for the job. It was just opening. I was an original hire and got the job, was there for, I would say around 4 to 5 years, maybe. And that's where I met, you know, my girlfriend, Anna Ortiz, who is also helping me. She's my right-hand man, I guess you would say, at the museum. She's kind of like my publicist slash like Girl Friday, my organizer. And I love her to death. I would not be here if it was not for her. And then once she went on to college, she went to Ball State University, and I kind of followed her there. And that's where I think my first chef position was at. I was working for a food truck called Slop on Top in Muncie. Muncie's or Ball State's first food truck, I have to say. So that was kind of cool. It was a very big honor to, you know, have that title. And so once she graduated and we moved back to the area and to Northwest Indiana, I got a job at Three Floyds Brewery, and I cooked there for a little while, and then went on to be the chef at Twincade. It's like a barcade, like a bar, you know, arcade in Griffith. I was a chef there. Then I was a chef at Off Square Brewing in Crown Point. Then I've also been chef at Tavern on Main here in Crown Point. And then I got the job here at Square Roots. I'm not the chef here at Square Roots. They offered me a position to kind of run one of their kitchens, but I kind of declined it. I kind of just wanted to like focus on, you know, me for a while. So I am, you know, still working for them. Love what I do here. I love working with them, helping everybody out. You know, I help write some of the recipes. But then we came across this opportunity with the museum at Lassen's Resort. And the wonderful lady that works there, Julie Zasada, we call her the General Julie. I got started with her last year. You know, that's when she kind of approached me and Anna, because Anna's family has deep roots with the museum at Lassen's. Anna's great-grandma used to be a maid at the museum at Lassen's. And then her grandma was a tour guide there. And so Anna was kind of like raised in that museum. So as I was saying, last year, Julie contacted me and Anna and, you know, approached us with this idea of, you know, doing like the dinner tours on the lake. And we thought it was a great idea. And so we tried it out. We did a couple of them. Just to see how they would go, just to test them. And they turned out awesome. We were really excited with the turnout. It was great. Like, one of the dinners that we did, actually, we weren't able to finish because, we were going through a drought, and in the middle of the drought, like the water level was so low that we weren't able to get the boats out on the water.
Oh my gosh.
We turned it around. Like, we didn't, you know, scrap the event. Like, instead we brought everybody inside the museum. We let them dine in the museum, and we actually got a lot of good like B-roll footage of me like serving them and cooking for them, and we turned that into like a promotional video. So like, we kind of took a negative and turned it into a positive. So that was really cool. And after that, I think after that event, Julie kind of realized that, hey, like, you know, we can make this work. And So that's when she kind of like extended the offer, like, hey, would you like to be the executive chef here at Lassen's, you know, museum? And I was like, you know what? Didn't want to do it here, square roots. I've been wanting to like work on myself. I kind of like felt like I'm in the spot now where I was like, you know what? Yeah, like this seems right. Let's do it. You know, it's a really cool opportunity. And I think the only reason I really did it is just because what we're doing with the museum is we're not just cooking for people. We're also giving them a history lesson and incorporating, you know, like, you know, anthropology and, you know, stuff like that. Like
whose brainchild was that? And
well, it originally was an idea of Julie's. It was kind of an idea of Julie's.
So was it a group discussion, take the Potawatomi heritage to focus on first?
Yeah, we kind of like, well, after we did the sunrise dinner boat dinners, or I mean the sunset, you know, dinner things with the boat, that's when we started like brainstorming, well, like what else can we do? What else can we do with this idea of, you know, culinary anthropology. And, that's when she kind of brought up, this doctor we've been working with, Dr. Ezekiel Flannery, and he's a really cool guy. And he's really like the expert, with the Potawatomi tribes. And, you know, we've got to talking with him and we've, you know, started developing this menu, based around, like traditional things that, you know, the Potawatomis would have eaten back in the day and, you know, still probably eat today. And not just the Potawatomis, but just like things in this area that are edible, you know, things that grow all around us that people just think are weeds. And people just kind of like disregard or like, you know, take the time and effort to get rid of out of their yards when in actuality, like these are delicious and nutritious things and also medicinal. And so we got the idea of, you know, like, hey, let's do this dinner. Let's, you know, show people that these things that grow all around us that are, you know, native to Northwest Indiana, which is one of the most biodiverse habitats in, you know, the country. Let's show these people that, you know, you can eat this stuff and not only just, you know, eat it, but you can actually make it nice, you know, make it, you know, really interesting. So that's kind of what we're doing right now. And that's what we're hoping to do. And we hope people really enjoy it.
So, and all locally available. Can you go over some of the menu? Maybe it was so, so intriguing. I mean, spotted bee balm leaves. It just sounds wonderful.
Right. Yeah. Like, and really until like, we talked with, Ezekiel Flannery, like I didn't even know about a lot of these things. Like I knew like things like dandelion you could eat. I've actually worked with dandelion before at Three Floyds Brewery. So I guess at Three Floyds Brewery, that's when my eyes were kind of opened to like, you know, hey, like some things that we consider weeds are actually very good and good for you. So I kind of had that in the back of my head and like, I've kind of like researched it a little bit before, Dr. Ezekiel. But he really opened my eyes to a lot more possibilities. And so now I'm very excited, you know, for this new menu, this 4-course menu. I think you guys got a copy of the menu, right?
What part of the dandelion gets used?
Well, you can eat every part of the dandelion. Every part of the dandelion is edible. But for the dish that I'm doing, I'm cooking the flowers, like the heads of the dandelion. I'm going to be, battering them in a tempura batter and frying them and making like little fritters out of them. And then like doing like a little drizzle of brie cheese and, juneberry, like a juneberry compote. And then, I think, is that the dish I'm using the spotted bee balm leaves.
That's true. Yes.
I'm going to be garnishing it with that. So,
well, and I saw in the video, the preparation that you, what you described, in fact, that's where I pulled your headshot from as a video freeze. But, does the menu vary from each experience, with the tour, or you do the same menu for each time? Like if someone would come back, would they have the same menu?
Well, as far as the dinner tours on the boats, it's going to be evolving. And that's mainly because like some things are going to be coming in and out of season, and we want to kind of give people an incentive to come back. to do it again. So some things will stay the same, some things will be changing. And then next year, it'll probably change all over again. So I want it to be something that's going to be completely, continually evolving. And then as far as, the other things that we're going to be doing, the menu for the dinner tours is going to be completely different than the menu for the Potawatomi dinner event. And then we also have other events, too. We're going to be doing, an art show and a speakeasy event. And then next year, there's talks about us doing a murder mystery, in the museum. And so every time we meet, we're always brainstorming. And it's actually really fun because, our meetings are usually only intended, maybe 20 minutes to a half an hour. But we always, wind up sitting down for, 2 hours just because, we just riff off of each other so well. We're we could do this. Oh, what about doing this? Oh, this will be fun. And we always wind up with 20 more ideas for something to do in the future. So I guess that's, quite a really good thing.
When the possibilities are endless, it's exciting.
Right. And I feel like that's exactly where we're at. We're just we've just barely opened the floodgates on, the inspiration for things that we can do. Because the different foods that we can introduce with native species of plants and stuff. But just the rich history of this area of Northwest Indiana and Cedar Lake, in specific. So with that, we're very excited about the possibilities of what we can be doing.
So do they actually eat on the little baby Dewey cruise itself? And so that means you have to kind of figure out small plates, or they eat, then go for the cruise?
Yes. It's going to be 5 courses. And the way we have it kind of figured out is 4 courses are going to be done on the boat. And then the 5th course, the dessert, will be eaten when you come back to the museum, and you're going to sit on the deck, facing the lake, watching the sunset while you eat your dessert.
And of course, weather dependent, it sounds like. So if you have a really windy day and you're probably not taking the little baby Dewey out there, that's shaky, right?
Yeah. But we have contingencies for that. If for whatever reason, the boat can't go out that day, we will be offering, a boat ride at a later time for people, but then we will also be letting people eat that dinner that they were promised that very same day, just in the museum. But then they can come back for, another boat ride in the future when the weather is more favorable. But hopefully that won't be a problem.
Well, one thing I always like to ask a chef is there a dream of a restaurant in your future, your own restaurant?
I think, my line of work, I think that's kind of the ultimate goal, but I have so many irons in the fire right now, as my mom would like to say, that's not even really a thought of mine at the moment. If it happens, it happens. If it does, great. But in the meantime, I still got plenty of things that I'm doing right now to keep me busy. My main focus right now is, the museum.
Right.
And I think our ultimate goal with the museum, and I don't know if I should be talking about this. Maybe Julie will yell at me for spilling the beans, but I think our ultimate goal with the museum is to ultimately get it back in, working order to be a hotel again, like a resort hotel. If we play our cards right, if things work out, then, the museum itself could be the restaurant.
Right.
But who knows?
When we interviewed Julie some time ago, she sort of, that was one of her visions, and that was down the road, I know. So that's, you're not really tipping the boat on anything, so to speak. Well, Eric, we need to wrap it up. Is there any final things you want to say? And also, this is going on actually all summer and everything, the food there, does it go into the fall at all? Do you do dinners or just mainly the summer time?
The dinner tours will be ending at the end of September, I believe. We do have other events going on after that, going into fall. We do have a Flavors of Fall event that we're going to be doing. Other than that, not exactly too sure if there's anything going on. I don't think there's, we will be doing something winter. We're going to be doing the Lassen's, the Taylor Ice Fest. So we will have a presence there. It's kind of like Cedar Lake's little version of the Chris Kindle Market.
Right.
And the first one was last year, and it was, you know, great turnout. So we're going to do it again. But over winter, not going to be, that's going to kind of be our off season. And I'm just going to be focusing, you know, purely on Square Roots here in Crown Point. But other than that, like any final remarks, I just want to say, you know, a big shout out to Julie and all the volunteers at Lassen's Resort. You know, they are a godsend. You know, we couldn't do anything without our volunteers, and definitely couldn't do anything without Julie. Julie Cezada is, like I said, she's the general, General Julie.
General Julie.
And other than that, you know, I couldn't do any of this without my own right-hand man. Or my right-hand woman, you know, Miss Anna Ortiz, the woman I love that I've been with for 15 years. So other than that, yeah, I can't really say anything else. Right now I feel like I'm blessed with these opportunities that I have, and I'm just losing sleep over making sure that I don't screw this up.
Sounds great. That's Eric Hines, who's the executive chef at Lassen Resort, and also you can catch him in Crown Point, Square Roots. Thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air and sharing not only your journey, but what's going on there with Cruz.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, guys.
Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts.
This is Mary Clark, the author of Dandelion Roots Run Deep, and you are listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM and WVLP 103.1 FM. We are pleased to welcome Tony Bianco to Art on the Air. Tony is a lifelong resident of Northwest Indiana. He started drawing at an early age and at 7 years old received a gift of oil paints. He has a varied career that started at Bethlehem Steel. Then he opened and owned a pizzeria in Valparaiso for 4 years, and then he opened an insurance agency. At this point, he started painting earnestly, entering shows, garnering awards, and solo exhibits. Currently, he is finishing a mural for the Washington Park Zoo in Michigan City. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Tony. It's very nice meeting you.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
Well, Tony, we're glad to have you. I saw you at the Art Barn, known your wife for several years in a completely different universe. But we want to know all about Tony here, your background story, your origin story. I like to say how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Tony.
I'll try and give a brief summary of it. I born in Gary, Mercy Hospital, baby, you know, to the Mercy or Methodist, and grew up in East Gary, when it was East Gary, not Lake Station. And, grew up with a big family. There was 10 of us. And what for the longest time was a 2-bedroom and then a 3-bedroom house. And I'm mentioning that only because when I got that set of oil paints when I was like 7, I don't know how they gave a 7, or even maybe I was 8. I don't know how you give a kid oil paints in limited space at that time because they smell. But God bless my parents. They did. And I painted. And that was my introduction to art, you know. So anyway, always drew, played around with different mediums, but never serious way, even through the teen years, you know. Started at Bethlehem Steel when I was 21. And it was out there that I first started messing with industrial stuff. I worked at the powerhouse out there. Across the street from us was the blast furnace. And I would sketch it sometimes and sometimes turn that into watercolors. And sold a couple of them, but never really pursued art that much then, except as a side hobby, which I guess it still is a side hobby, but I spent a lot more time doing it now.
Well, I was just wondering, in your schooling, what were the art classes like? Did anybody notice that you had drawing skills?
I think so. Like in high school, in grade school, for sure. I had a good teacher in the fourth grade, actually, Joe Stevens. I think Joe's still in the area. He was a great teacher. And I was shy, quiet as a kid, maybe like a lot of artists, I guess. I don't know. I was. And Joe would kind of put me out in the forefront by doing things to put on the bulletin board for class functions or whatever. So, I mean, I give Joe credit for giving me my first exposure in a public way, I guess, in a classroom, you know. And then high school, same thing. I think people saw I had some talent, but I never pushed it. They never pushed it, you know. But just kept doing the stuff as time went on.
And something not related to art, what was your birth order?
Oh, I was in the middle. Well, there was eight kids. I got my parents into 10. I was fourth born. So me and my brother Mike anchored the middle of the of the clan.
Tell us about some of your favorite subjects to do, like maybe, and how that's changed over the years. Do you talked about, you know, you're doing like things at the steel mill, but then what are some of the subjects you have done?
Yeah, as a kid, I was doing like a lot of kids, where you're drawing soldiers and war scenes and all your pets, whatever, odds and ends, goofy pictures to try and make fun of your brother or sister or something, you know. But as time went on, I guess I started turning more towards landscapes primarily, particularly the natural world, or scenes in my neighborhood or whatever neighborhood I might have been living at the time as I got older, moved to Porter County. And it was right about the time I started insurance, which would have been, maybe I was 29. I'd sold my pizzeria, 28, 29. I started the insurance. Anyways, I had more time for painting. I had kids, young kids. You get a little more responsible and you go home more. And I started pursuing it. And I'm learning in my own way. I never had really schooling for art, but learning from the artists who I appreciated. And it was Andrew Wyeth, all the Wyeths for that matter, Edward Hopper, all the ash can artists for the New York City guys that starts painted street scenes and the industrial world around them. And they inspired me. And Andrew Wyeth in particular, because it was him, I started reading on him, and he doesn't talk technique, but I dug other methods and learned about how he does egg tempera and how any artist does egg tempera. And he introduced me to egg tempera, which is a real awakening experience. A very time-consuming medium, but very something you can really learn a lot from, you know, that you can apply it to other mediums as you go to that technique, you know.
It's really just practice, looking and practicing.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the kind of thing like a guy, how do guys say, if they, let's say you're in a store and your wife sees a piece of furniture and she says, I like that, I can make that, you know, just make it, you know. You sometimes you can't, most of the time you can't, but you think you can. But when it comes to painting, I still feel if there's a picture there, I think I can, you know, you give me an image, I can paint it, figure out a way to paint it. But of course, I like to work off my own images and photos.
That's what I was going to ask, is about your process. How do you always work from photos, or do you work from a sketch? And then, so tell us about your process from seeing an image and then rendering it to your canvas or whatever your medium you're doing.
So when I look for an image, and the problem with images is anybody who does art can relate to, there's an infinite number of good images out there. So you got to narrow it down, right? And so one of the things I look for is mainly breaking it down into tones, contrast, darks and lights, the balance, how it falls in place, just how it hits my eye. And it's usually just a gut feeling. There's no formula. I'm not using any theorems or the golden angle, although I think all that stuff, there's something to it, but it's how it hits me. So once I see something that hits me properly, basically I'm looking for tones. So if it's from a photo, for example, and mostly I do work a lot of my photos. I may take images from different photos and put them together. But what I'll start with then is not a detailed sketch, but what I call the thumbnail. And I do several thumbnails. And that's maybe with just the side of a pencil. And I'm just darkening in the darks and leaving the lights alone and just seeing how that balances out. And that thumbnail might be the size of a 2x2 or 2-inch by 3-inch square. You know, there's not much to it. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is, when you do a thumbnail and you do it spontaneously, for me, and I think for a lot of other people, sometimes that's better than the painting as far as in the spontaneity, because you caught it. Now you're going to sit down and spend 30, 40, 50 hours on a painting. And the spontaneity, you know, the great artists can keep that spontaneity, and guys like us just keep trying to do it, you know. And that's kind of what it's all about. So anyway, what I'll do then, once I get that figured out, then I actually start doing the painting. I follow, and it's a technique I still do. And again, it came from the egg tempera painters. And there was a book years ago I read from the 1930s, the guy wrote it, Philip Thompson, The Art of Tempera Painting. And he goes into detail of how you cross-hatch this paint on, and you do an underpainting and glaze your color over it. And that's what I do. So the first thing I'll do is start the underpainting. And I'll start that underpainting. I'll pick something on this darker side, but it doesn't have to be dark. But I'll stay with that color. My whole underpainting will be, so maybe half the time I spend on a painting, if I put 40 hours in a painting, 20 plus hours is in the underpainting. I'm laying the foundation. I'm putting up the bumper pads with that drawing so that when I start glazing color on there, that's the easy part, you know, and I'm kind of limited in my color palette anyway, but the underpainting is where all the work is, you know, and it's over that I then bring out more stuff out of that foundation I laid down.
Is there any subject that you haven't done that you want to do? Like, I know you seem like kind of a generalist, you see what you want, but is there something, I really like to do? What is that?
Yeah, I don't know if I'll ever do it because it's a whole nother thing. But first off, I love doing landscapes. I love painting the area. You know, I love painting where I'm from and what I see around here. And I love when other people recognize things I paint. I think that sense of pride, or when you record something and put it on a canvas, it takes on a different angle in your mind rather than just something you drive by and never look at twice or never see an image or anybody that took the time to save that image for you to see, you know. But the thing I think I would like to do someday, I thought of this for years, still haven't really done it, is more in with people in my art, you know. And I paint people periodically, but I guess I'm not a perfectionist, but I'm not where I'd like to be. And I don't know if I have the time to spend 10 years learning how to be a portraiture guy, you know, anyways, you know. Besides, I really like what I'm doing with landscape anyway. And I feel I'm just scratching the surface on that anyways, you know.
Do you ever do plein air?
No, not in a group, you know. Now, I'll mess around sometimes in my own backyard, but no, I'm pretty much a studio painter. But I would like to try that. I know the people in Duneland, they've invited me several times, and I'm going to have to take them up on that someday.
Well, you know, we have about 1 minute left, and we want to give you a time to talk about exhibits you are in and going to be in this upcoming time.
Yeah, so I just had a show open. It's the biggest show I've ever had. And the cool thing about this show to me is it's all industrial-based. Now, I've never had enough pieces for an industrial show. I do now, and thank to Brian Byrne and Randy over at the Elkhart Midwest Museum of American Art. We've got a 20-piece show in the main gallery there. The show looks great. I'm so proud of it. And that's going to be open till July 14th. And if you're out the Elkhart way, check it out, especially anybody from Northwest Indiana. You might see a couple scenes nobody really ever painted for you before, just the industry and stuff there, you know.
Make a special trip out there because Brian, Randy, and the museum are just top notch.
They're top notch, is right.
Tony, tell people your website.
Yeah, the website is tonybiancopaint.com, and that site's been up and running for a while. So, yeah, you can go on there, and if you like it, sign up for my email on there. I don't send out many. You might get one or two a year, but or newsletters or blogs, but you know, I won't bombard you, I promise you.
Sounds great. That's Tony Bianco, artist who's been in quite a few things, grew up in the area, from a lifelong Northwest Indiana resident, has a great story. You can find him at tonybiancopaint.com. Tony, thank you so much for coming on Art on the Air.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you, Tony.
Thank you.
If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell it to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode.
Hi, this is Morgan McCabe, freelance theater professional and writer for the Northwest Indiana Times. You are listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM. Thanks for listening.
We would like to welcome Anna Barris to Art on the Air. Anna is the artist, entrepreneur, and instructor behind Star Girl Crafts. She is a Northwest Indiana-based mixed media artist and instructor. Her home bases are in Valparaiso and Westville. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha. Aloha and welcome, Anna. It's very nice meeting you.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Anna, all of our guests, we like to know their origin story. And I always like to say it like this, how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about yourself and how you got to Star Girl Crafts.
All right. So I've always been very interested in arts and crafts ever since I was a little girl. I had a lot of support from both of my parents. They're both interested in my interests as a kid. So I started doing different types of art and craft shows around the age of 12 and 13. And with their support, I was able to start selling my artwork. I also was selling artwork to my peers at summer camps and at school. So that's kind of how I dipped my toes into the water as being a young artist and selling my work and what it's like to be an entrepreneur and a small business owner.
So can you tell us what was on that table? What were you selling initially? Those first young crafts.
Yeah. So the first few things that I started selling were recycled art. So I would take beer caps, and I would clean them off real nice, and then I would turn them into magnets. So that was one of the first crafts that I was selling were upcycled cap magnets. And I also was making polymer clay charms. So I loved to spend hours in my room sculpting little animals or little foods. I even got into making miniatures, like dollhouse size miniatures. And I really fell in love with sculpting and texture and all that fun stuff. So those were two of the main things that I first started selling when I was a kid.
That's a great place to start.
Did you have anyone early in your life that influenced you, art teachers, anyone else, and maybe early classes that you took?
So I took all of the available art classes at my high school. So I graduated from Westville High School, and I had just started there during my freshman year. So I was only at Westville for the 4 years, and I took the opportunity to take every single art class that I possibly could there. Beforehand, I had taken, I believe I took a photography class through the Boys and Girls Club summer camp. But other than that, all of the art classes that I had taken were through the school, through whatever school that I was taking. Art class was always my favorite class when I was in elementary and middle school. So once, by the time I was in high school, I was like, okay, I'm going to take every single one that I possibly can, make sure it fits into my schedule. So, yeah.
So did you grow up in a family that was creative? Are your parents artists or musicians?
So I have quite a bit of an entrepreneurial side on my dad's side. So on the Barris side of the family, we have my father, Jason Barris. He has been an entrepreneur since before I was born. He's been making websites. His business is called Datamine. And he's, like I said, he's been doing his business since the 90s. I was born in 2000. So he's been doing his website building and maintenance for over 20 years. And also on my dad's side is my aunt, his sister, my aunt April Barris. She is also a entrepreneur. She has a small business called Cauldron, where she makes different elixirs. And she also is a masseuse. So I have some entrepreneurial in my on the Barris side of the family. Now, my mother, Tara Simonson, she is most recently a quilter. She's been quilting for about 3 or 4 years now. And most of her works are for donation. She does a few custom pieces here and there, but she really does it to donate her quilts that she makes. And she donates most of them to the Knights of Columbus. So most of them go to children in need.
That sounds wonderful. Well,
I know, it's a rich artistic background.
So do you, after high school, did you have anything, obviously you were setting up and running a business, but did you have any further studies with anyone, college or other specialty courses you took?
Oh yeah, I definitely had my mentors growing up. So my first mentor would be my high school art teacher. Her name is Molly Olchel. I called her Mrs. O or Mrs. Olchel in high school. And I've actually been able to stay connected with her throughout college. I've seen her a few times at some of the events that I've been at, which is really awesome to see a familiar face and somebody that's been with me kind of from like the beginning of my art career through. So she was one of the first mentors that I had. And she was a high school art teacher at Westville. I know that she's teaching at a different school now, but she's still within the region. And she graduated from Valparaiso University. So she helped me kind of know, like, hey, there's actually a local university that you can get an art degree at and still be a commuter. So she was my first mentor, I would say, other than my parents. And in college, I have two mentors from college. So my first advisor and mentor was Amy Tomasek. Amy Tomasek is a photographer around the area, around Valpo, Wanata area. And she's an amazing woman. She's really out here to help out us young artists who are just starting our careers at VU. So I absolutely love her, and I still am connected with her and working with her too. She's a lovely woman. And my third and last mentor would be Sarah Jancy. So Sarah Jancy was one of my professors and advisors at Valparaiso University. She teaches a lot of the studio art classes, painting and drawing classes. And she helped me get some good opportunities through the university. So I was able to work on a mural at the university that's in BB's Cafe. It was me and two other students, Zion Gifford and Eric Hernandez. The three of us worked on a brand new mural in the new cafe space that they had. And our professor, Sarah Jancy, basically nominated us to work on this mural together. So she's helping students get opportunities to do work around the university as well as outside of the university. So she actually helped me get into instructing. And so I've recently discovered my passion for teaching others how to make all the fun and cool things that I know how to make.
Right. And that was going to be what I was going to just ask you about, was how the evolution of your classes and workshops and how you chose what you decided to offer.
Yeah. So for classes and workshops and instructing, I had first done my first workshops while I was a senior at VU. So for our one of the classes I took my senior year, I took two studio art classes. For one of them, one of the projects was to have some type of workshop. And it's basically a public workshop where you invite anybody and everybody involved with the university. And so I had at least 20 or 25 people show up to my workshop that I did. And it was an artist trading card workshop. So I led people through doing a magazine collage and basically just designing these small 2.5 by 3.5 sized cards, and the concept behind artist trading cards, which is to make a small artwork on a small card and trade it with other artists. So it's a good way to build an art collection for free. Obviously, not everybody can afford artwork, and artwork can be really expensive if you're looking for like a larger piece. So if you're somebody who's wanting to get into building an art collection, I highly suggest you look into artist trading cards. There's also variations like artist trading coins, which are little round pieces that are mixed media collage that people trade the same way as they do the cards. So that was my first workshop. And after that, I had learned about an instructor opportunity at Michaels in Valpo. So I taught at Michaels in Valpo. I was their in-store class instructor for a little over a year. And I was given the okay to teach classes outside of the store as long as it wasn't the same things I was teaching there. You know, conflict of interest kind of thing. So I was approached by Jamie from the Independent Cat Society. And she said that she would like me to do some type of class as a fundraiser. And I was like, that sounds like a great opportunity. What are you looking for? And she sent me a video of a hand crochet pet bed. I was like, I already know how to crochet and I already know how to hand knit blankets. So I could totally do this. So I learned how to make the pet beds and I did the class and we raised a couple $100 for the Independent Cat Society. And I was like, well, that's great. I'm going to, you know, keep doing some of my own classes. So basically some recent news would be right around the beginning of January, Michaels had decided to close their in-store class program. And this was about 2 or 3 days before I had that hand crochet pet bed class. So it was kind of, you know, one door closing and three more opening up for me. So although I'm not teaching classes at Michaels anymore, I'm still promoting myself as an instructor, and I have a good amount of people in my community that have been really helpful and letting me know, like, hey, there's this space that you can teach at and whatnot. So since then, I've just been teaching classes on my own, being a freelance artist. I've been doing private lessons, weekly lessons. So it's been a lot of fun, and things have been really looking up for me since then.
Where can people find you?
So people can find me through my website, stargirlcrafts.com, all one word. And my social media pages, I have a Facebook page, it's stargirlcrafts. And my Instagram is stargirl_crafts. And I also have a TikTok that's just stargirlcrafts.
Well, Anna, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air, sharing your art journey. Anna Barris, you can find her at Stargirl Crafts on Facebook and on her website. And watch for her teaching things in the Valpo and Porter County area. Thank you so much for coming on Art on the Air.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operation for Lakeshore Public Media, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts, give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or send us information about your arts, arts-related event or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart.